Next up, we have Jocelyn Arum and Jessica Thompson to talk about their Cafe Lena project. I'm going to cut the introductions short in the interest of time, except to say that Cafe Lena is one of the legendary venues for folk music in the United States, going back to the early days of the folk revival. And what they've done is, you know, not simply to present a legacy, but to resurrect it and make it live again for music lovers today. So, Jocelyn Arum and Jessica Thompson.
Hello. I don't know if they can hear. Thanks, Matt. Can y'all hear me? If I speak like this? No?
No.
I switch me on? Can you hear me now? Okay.
I'm sure I got it. All right.
We're a duo, so we're going to see if we can swing this. Can you step over real quick? There you go.
Ta-da.
Got it?
Got it.
Okay. That way you can see both of us.
Okay.
All right. We can do it like this. Good morning.
Hi.
How are y'all doing? Are you enjoying ARSC?
Yeah. Are you?
I'm enjoying it a lot.
It's our first time.
This is our first time here. Welcome. We're excited to be with y'all.
And you're not on.
And I'm going to wait until it steps up. Did y'all get some tintype photographs yesterday? Yeah? Almost there? Am I good? Well, I really want to thank ARSC for having us here while we're getting set up. And Matt Barton and our fellow presenters. It was a great talk. Two talks, actually. Yeah.
Oh.
Yep. Yeah, we got to plug it in. That's the key to everything with recorded sound, right? You got to plug it in a lot of time. So we're gonna talk to you today about the Cafe Lena History Project, from archives to zip files. I'm just gonna introduce myself, and then Jessica will introduce herself, and we'll take you through what we're gonna talk about, and have a good time, play you some sound recordings in the middle of it. So I'm Jocelyn Arum. I went to school here at UNC Chapel Hill, so it's really fun to be back. I live in New York now. And I've been producer and consultant, but I worked on this project for 12 years. I started it when I was in college and discovered a place called Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs, New York, which has an amazing history for presenting folk music and emerging artists as well as traditional artists. And met Jessica through the project when I brought the sound recordings that I had been working with to the Magic Shop studio in New York City, where Jessica works.
Jessica Thompson. I work at the Magic Shop recording studios. We do recording, mixing, mastering, remastering, and archiving, a whole lot of everything. And I met Jocelyn through this project when I got the incredible pleasure and honor of remastering some of these recordings for the box set.
Yeah. So we'll tell you about what we did as during the course of this project. And you can see this okay if I'm standing here? Just kind of get the floor.
You're really in the way of the picture.
Am I in the way of the picture?
Yes.
I don't want to be in the way of the picture.
Do you want to come stand next to me?
Can I stand up here?
Yeah.
All right. I want to be able to show you the picture. Okay. So from archives to zip files, we're going to show you how over the course of 6 years with Jessica and I working together on this recorded sound collection, we took it from these tapes that you see on the left to our friend Matt here holding up the CD, which we actually have with us today, the 3-CD box set, and some other outcomes that we'll tell you about as well. Can we raise it up a little bit? Is it possible to do that? I don't know, Brendan. It's a little bit low. It's supposed to be higher, if you can. So the three stages that we'll talk to you about that we went through the process with the Cafe Lena collection are collecting, preserving, and presenting. So how we went through the process of collecting the sound recordings in the first place, I'll tell you a little bit about the background. And Jessica will get into really the preservation part, and that's what she worked on the most, preserving the materials, and then presenting the different ways that we brought the archives out into the world and made them accessible to you guys. Can you see it in the bottom? Okay. So Cafe Lena, like I was saying before, is the oldest continuously running folk music coffee house in the country, which is really exciting because a lot of these places have closed up. The audience for folk music has waxed and waned since the 1960s. And this is Cafe Lena when it opened in 1960. And this is Cafe Lena today, in 2014. So you can see it's actually still pretty similar. And And this is me in 2000. I was 19, and I discovered Cafe Lena when I was going to college at Skidmore College nearby. And I thought, what a cool place. I really want to play music here. And I had just started writing my own songs, so I performed there. and had no idea that it was like this mecca of folk music, right? And there had been artists who had performed there since the 1960s that had been, as the Rolling Stone said, misfits, poets, and prophets coming there because it was a fabled New York club during and long after the folk boom. So it's really important to understand that Cafe Lena is still there today. So we worked on sound recordings from 1967 through 2013, which was a lot of fun and very complicated in certain ways that Jessica can tell you about. So some of you know this guy, I think, Bob Dylan. Played there in 1961. Is it possible to raise it up a little bit, Brendan? Not so much. Okay, we have some photo credits. It's fine. And the Freedom Singers also performed there, and obviously major figures on the civil rights movement. So it was a place where big social movements were happening and coming, passing through. Cafe Lena gave these people a space and a vehicle to perform. Mm-hmm. Feel free to jump in anytime if you have things to say. Pete Seeger, mm-hmm. We had recording from Pete Seeger in the audio collection, performed there in 1962. So even folks who had been on the scene for a little while and weren't necessarily emerging knew this was an important place to play.
Yeah. I'll just add, even more than a folk venue, mm-hmm. it was really a place where people were nurtured, where their careers were able to flourish mm-hmm. and grow. And Lena, the Lena of Cafe Lena, mm-hmm. was a mother figure to all of these folk artists who came through. So from its earliest days to now, it mm-hmm. is a community of people, much more than just mm-hmm. a venue where people play and move on.
Yeah. So we just want to give you a sense, as some of the other presenters did in their talks, about the background and the history of the recorded sound archives that you're going to listen to that we'll show you. But everyone from Mississippi John Hurt to my buddy Danielle Moralia, who some of you know in the audience today, played blues music, shared the same stage. So these are decades apart, Mississippi John in 1961 and Danielle in 2011, and she is playing his music there on the same stage. So it's really exciting.
This
is where we started. We had these archives that Lena had collected over the course of the time when she ran the club. So Lena died in 1989, and when she died, she had saved, up until that point, materials and papers and letters from Pete Seeger, menus, all of the kind of memorabilia. And some of you, how many of you here have collections of your own that you're working on? And how many of you work with collections from other people, recorded sound collections? So it's a lot of stuff. It can sometimes feel like a lot to get through, and we were overwhelmed, you know, honestly, getting into it at first. But finding things like this, it's exciting. You know, you get really involved in the treasure hunt, right? And so for us, coming into this, we realized that it needed some organization, right? And we wanted to find a way to structure it and make it accessible. So the way that we did that was through the Cafe Lena History Project, which I initiated in 2002, a few years after you saw me playing. I was digging through the archives, right? And I thought, well, it would be so great if we could do a coffee table book. That was what Lena always wanted, was a way to showcase the photographs and the stories of all of these performers who had played there. The second thing that sort of emerged, and we'll talk about with you, and we'll focus on today, is the CD box set. So I met an audio engineer at the Magic Shop who said, what if you could do a box set of the recordings and present it alongside the book? And these were the goals, right, in 2002. The third thing was an exhibition, and down here, if you can see, a website, which we eventually did as well. So the first step was the collecting, right? Before we knew what we had to go out and assess it. And we'll focus today on the audio recordings. That's what you guys are most interested in. And Steve Rosenthal, who some of you guys might know, I think Matt Barton knows Steve Rosenthal really well, emailed me when he knew that I was working as a student, basically, on the project, and said, if you find any audio recordings, I'm your guy. I think that I can help you. And I had no idea at the time. I think at that point had won 3 Grammy Awards for preserving audio recordings and done amazing restoration work, right? And I had no idea what I was getting into at the time, but I thought, well, he seems to know what he's doing, and we'll see what we can collect for him, and then we'll work together. At that point, we had 10 shows, I think from 1968, around that time. In 6 years of working with Steve and working with Jessica and scouring the country and sending emails and contacting radio stations, we came up with 700 shows from 1967 all the way through, I mentioned last year. And these are some of the tapes that we found, and Sleepy John Estes was one of them. And this is Joe Jewell, who's the sound engineer at Cafe Lena still today, with his cassette tapes, and he had recorded off the soundboard guys like Dave Van Ronk and Kay and Anna McGarrigle, just amazing stuff that no one had ever heard before. And this is the kind of treasure I'm sure you guys are finding in your collections, and you want to figure out a way to organize and preserve it. Here's Steve, who's so very happy that we had found what he thought was out there. And Dick Kavanaugh, who was one of the board members, showed up with a duffel bag with 300 cassette tapes in this duffel bag. And it was a lot of fun. So now I'm going to turn it over to Jessica, and she can talk a little bit about the preservation aspect.
Yes, yeah. We started with 10 tapes. Mm-hmm. But you know if there are 10, you know there are more. Mm-hmm. And with Jocelyn's help and a lot of other people who, you know, she brought to the team, we got these 700 tapes to the Magic Shop Recording Studios in New York, where I work. And we assembled a team of people to do the reformatting. Now, we're talking about 50 years of recorded history here, so we had pretty much every format you could imagine people would record on at a venue like Cafe Lina's. We had a lot of reel-to-reel tapes, we had cassettes, we had DATs, we had born digital files, mm-hmm. and they were all reformatted, organized, cataloged, put onto hard drives, mm-hmm. and eventually delivered to the Library of Congress. Okay. But that was only one phase of working with the audio. Mm-hmm. And
Jessica found some interesting things with these tapes. One of the things she found was...
the marijuana?
Joint. We found a joint in one of the tapes.
Yeah, you'd be surprised what you find in some of these tape boxes mm-hmm. from the folk venues.
So, you know, we're talking about authentic artifacts here, guys. Authentic.
Was it cataloged? I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Okay, so we had fun. We found some really interesting things.
It was. I mean, this is, like, the treasure hunt part one is finding the tapes. The treasure hunt part two is listening to them. Mm-hmm. And some of them sounded amazing. Some of these recordings went on the box set with the lightest of touch. The Gene Ritchie tape, I can tell you, it's practically a flat transfer on the box set. Some of them, however, had a huge range of problems. Hedy West had... This is the before, right?
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what they're hearing? What problems?
Then they can't hear.
Can you hear that? Okay.
So here's what happened with Hedy West. She just kills it. It's a beautiful, beautiful performance of Shady Grove. But Hedy West is walking around the stage. Fades out.
It's going to fade out. Don't worry, Chris. This is the after.
My true love slided me and broke my heart in two, because I was a poor little fella and I didn't know how to do. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, my honey, Shady Grove, my little love, I'm going to Shady Grove.
You want to talk about the difference?
Yeah, so I can tell you what happened with that one. She was walking around the stage, which, if you were at Lena's, would sound perfectly normal, and you would just be mesmerized by her playing. Mm-hmm. But when you listen to it in the context of the box set, it sounded really bizarre because the tone of her banjo changed so much. So one of the little restoration things I had to do on this recording was sneak in there and very, very subtly fix this 10-second section where her banjo was pointed off the stage and not on mic. And through various little mastering engineer tricks and make it seem like a steady recording.
Mm-hmm.
If I've done my job, you don't know I've done that. So if I've done my job in that case, I'm invisible. Mm-hmm. That was one of the really minor problems we encountered on these recordings. Some of them were really severely damaged, either through years of sitting in basements or just... You know, a lot of the sound engineers, when they recorded these tapes at Lena's, they were focused on front-of-house sound. They wanted it to sound good for the room. They just hit record mm-hmm. on a player. They didn't know what they were getting. So then we got things like the McGarrigles.
Okay, we'll play you the before. And this is the after. A little bit better, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, terrible, terrible distortion problems. Mm-hmm. Really bizarre left and right stereo imaging. And my job throughout the whole restoration process mm-hmm. was to make you feel, as a listener, like you're sitting in the cafe and Dave Van Ronk is heckling whoever's on stage and Lena's serving you a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm. So we really tried, and Jessica really tried, obviously, and the magic that she did as her part of the project in the preservation stage was to be thoughtful and mindful of making it sound as authentic to the venue as she possibly could. And the major challenge was, because we had these tapes from 1967 to last year, there's a huge span, obviously, of recording formats and quality of recording that she had to seamlessly integrate into one final presentation. So we were really pleased, I have to say, with her work, and the way that she was so careful in doing that was really extraordinary.
And I will say there were problems in the 2013 recordings that were similar to problems in the 1967 recording, so it was across the map. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, can I tell them the Lena Bump thing?
Yeah, tell them the Lena Bump.
So we discovered through the course of remastering that the room at Cafe Lena's had a frequency buildup in the kind of lower mid-range. Mm-hmm. It was actually around 472 hertz. And a majority of these recordings had these just big bumps around that frequency range, kind of the low end of the voice or, you know, middle of the guitars. Mm-hmm. And I would listen to them and I'd be like, oh, there's a big bubble there. It just sounds all like mushy and bubbly. Pop the bubble. Pop the Lena bubble.
And that was consistent from the 60s to last year?
Yeah, it's the same room. All of the recordings were stamped with Lena's presence, with the space.
Yeah, so it was a really interesting process because you're talking about one space that hasn't changed really in over 50 years and the recordings that have been done there over 50 years.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting process. So the second part.
And then the end of this phase of the archiving process, mm-hmm. We boxed up the tapes, we boxed up the hard drives, mm-hmm. and everything has now gone to the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm. Some of you guys know Todd, and now the entire Cafe Lena collection is preserved at the American Folklife Center. So the preservation part that Jessica did on the audio recordings, plus the preservation of the physical assets that we had. The third thing that we're going to talk about, we've talked to you now about the collecting that we did and all of those guys that had all of those tapes and ladies that had all those tapes that they donated, the preservation that Jessica did on the actual recordings and the preservation of the physical material. And then we had to figure out a way that we were going to present it, right? So many of you have collections, and there's a question about preservation, and then there's the question about access, right? That so many people at ARS and outside of ARS talk about how to get access to this great material. It's not doing anybody any good necessarily if it can't be enjoyed and understood the value, right, that we had. So one of the things that we decided to do, like I told you in the Cafe Lena History Project goals, was to create a 3-CD box set. So we were really fortunate that out of 700 shows, we had the ability to curate, right? So we selected 47 tracks over 3 CDs. And we worked with Tompkins Square record label that does a lot of great reissues and put together this 3-CD box set. So that was one of the ways that we decided to preserve and present was through the box set, which luckily for us was worked out perfectly to be published and presented in tandem with the coffee table book that I mentioned that we were working on that came out at the same time. And I'm pleased to report that the book and the CD box set have now sold out and are going into second printings. With the presentation of the music, we also decided there's so much material, there's 700 shows, how do we create even more access? We were just really excited and energized about finding and discovering all this amazing audio, you know, recorded material, and we wanted to find yet another way to get it into the hands of people who could enjoy it and learn from it and use it, right? And one of the ways that we did that, also, you know, through putting it at the Library of Congress for researchers, was creating a database, a searchable digital online database for all of this material, including the photographs that I showed you before, the stories and the memorabilia that Lena had saved, and the audio recordings are now cataloged. The entire thing is digitized, and it's listed in this digital database, which you can search. It was down here, but I'll tell it to you. www.history.cafelena.org, and you can actually search by artist, and then you can find the accession reports for each recording, which details the songs and the tracks and all of the metadata, which we're really excited about.
And this website's available to anyone. It's just
free.
Online.
It's free and it's online. So that was one of the other ways that we presented the material. And this is Danielle, who's the musician you saw earlier with Mississippi John Hurt, enjoying the database. So it's great that it's accessible to musicians and the public. When we presented in terms of the 3-CD box set, we were so excited that we were number one on Amazon.
Hot new release.
Hot new release under folk music, and as well as the New York Times. So this is some of the publicity that we got from the project. For the front page of the arts section did a feature. This is Pete Kennedy and David Amram, some of you guys might know, some of the musicians, right, helped us out with the publicity. We had a major coming together of performers over 50 years who had played there, and a big celebration, a big gathering. So
yeah, and this was a huge part of this process, too, because after the collecting and the preserving and the cataloging, Jocelyn produced these things that could be shared, and then the public knew about it and was interested in it, and it was great to have the New York Times respond to that and share things about Cafe Lena and spread the word, so researchers now know it's at the Library of Congress and then go look it up, or they can go online and look it up. It's accessible to a wide, not just a wide audience, but lots of different audiences. Mm-hmm. People interested in the photographs can focus on the book, and people interested in the music can focus on the box set, and researchers can have access to a much deeper breadth of, of information from Lena's.
And that's one of the reasons why we're very excited in presenting to you guys today, and just encourage you, and we'd love to hear more about other people working on projects that utilize multimedia platforms, because a lot of this material, when you put it in context and you present it in different kinds of ways, can be really exciting to generate all different kinds of interest in your work. And just to recap, do you want to talk to them about this?
Yeah, sure. So thanks to Jocelyn's incredible hard work over 12 years, she brought together really a large team of people and volunteers. We had over 1,000 staff hours, volunteers and staff, that went into the cataloging, preserving, and putting together of the commercial products. We had donations from the community. We were able to fund this. That's like a whole another presentation, able to fund it through a lot of grant writing as well as working with corporate sponsors. We got 2 Grammy Foundation Preservation grants. Mm-hmm. You got an Arts grant, didn't you?
I had Arts grants to do my research, right? I should have mentioned that.
Yeah, you did.
So thank you to Arts for helping this project happen. Really appreciate
that. Yeah, and then, you know, partnering with the Magic Shop Studios so we could work on all of the audio materials. Mm-hmm. You partnered with
The database was the Mellon Foundation grant. Yeah. The Cataloging Hidden Collections grant made our database possible. So we did a lot of grant writing. And pulling resources together. So there's lots of different ways you can support different aspects of this kind of work. And just to encourage you, and you're already doing this, I'm sure, but really reaching out to grants and to individual donors and things like that.
And then partnering with a record label and a publisher and, you know, the recording studio and the Library of Congress. So all of these different partners and team members
and
came
experts
together.
Who do preservation work and mastering.
Came together and made it happen.
Yeah, so the collaborations have been one of the best parts of doing this work and working with people like Jessica, who are experts in their field, who know how to handle this audio material, so that someone like me, who's just a producer and a consultant and a networker, can tap into their expertise. So we've had really, as you can see, a really fun time that we're excited to share with you guys today.
Yeah, and really, when it comes down to it, we want to show you that if Jocelyn can do this with Lena, it is possible to take these dusty boxes and, you know, diasporas of recorded materials. Mm-hmm. It's possible to bring them together, to catalog them, preserve them, and present them in a lot of different ways for a lot of different audiences.
Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for listening to us. We encourage you to go forward with your work. We're really excited to hear about what's going on at ARSC. And thanks for having us at the conference.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can I unplug? Okay,
we actually have time for a question or two. Yes, Chris.
I was wondering if the people from the Cafe Lena got permission from all of the artists to use this material and to publish it.
We certainly did. We did. We did permission forms for everyone, and that was one of the wonderful things, was that we had such support from these artists and the whole community. We went through a very diligent permission process. We did.
Yes, Michael.
Did they know at the time that the soundboard was being recorded?
Did the artists know at the time that the soundboard was being recorded? Yes. And Joe Jewell, who was one of the recording engineers, was careful to speak with all of those artists, which was great.
It was in their performance contract.
Yes.
Being recorded?
Yeah, it was, you know, all of this was really carefully documented. And in some of the cases of the very early recordings, you know, we're not sure. And we have done our best, most diligent job to do research on every single recording to try to track them as carefully as we possibly could. So we were really careful in our research throughout that process.
Chris, you had another question?
Yeah. Philadelphia, when I recorded at the clubs, they knew
I was recording. Right, exactly. It's very important.
Yes.
Right.
I have another question for the
Chris.
Calypso Soca meeting. What is the current popular sound carrier that is still being used in Trinidad and Tobago?
Sound carrier. The sound format, yeah.
A combination of downloads, MP4s, that's what they're using. But it's a combination of all of the various types, yeah? But that.
Are there still 45s being pressed? Or?
No, no, definitely not. No 33 and a third, no 45s, yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Mostly, actually, what's happening is that new soca artists are not even producing CDs anymore, right? They just have it as downloadable. Some people have actually gotten onto iTunes as well, so that is the format that is currently being used. Yeah.
Okay. Bill Doggett in the back.
First off, I want to thank all of you ladies for this outstanding session. All of you were wonderful. And I have to, of course, personally connect with Jocelyn at a later point about some projects that I want to work with, since she's such an outstanding producer, so I just want to say that. But for Megan, I was listening to the music from the range of music from beginning to end, and of course, one of the things that struck me that I'm not the first one to say this, I'm sure Chris might even chime in on this, I'm hearing Cuban son, and I'm hearing Afro-Cuban in some of the early Calypso material. I'm, of course, because the diaspora and in the West Indies has not only French and Spanish, but also very clearly also African. I heard in there quite a bit of other influences. Why don't you speak to that?
Arsk also promotes physical fitness.
As I would have indicated, there was a lot of internal migration that would have taken place within the islands, so that you would hear those influences, definitely. Because if you have people coming from St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Dominica and Barbados, etc., coming to Trinidad, they're each coming from all of the their separate spaces, but with the European colonizers that would have come to their particular country and the traditions that they would have brought. In particular, I didn't get an opportunity to play any music from Tobago, but the music from Tobago sounds very similar to the folk music that I've been hearing at this conference, because they use the fiddle. That's what they use, and it's very interesting. So that's what's been happening. So you have, with the European expansion, you have all of those migratory changes taking place. So you have the Europeans coming over, the Africans, as I indicated, the East Indians, all of that. You're going to hear that Latin folk, Bhangra, chutney, you're going to hear that. So that you are correct, definitely.
Okay. You and then Vincent.
J&J. I'm wondering if you could tell me about what was on those tapes outside of the music. As a historian, I'm wondering, were you able to listen to those tapes outside of the music, and did it give you anything in the way of a coherent history on, say, a 20 or 25-year history of what goes on in a coffee house over the span of a 25-year history that struck you as in the way of a compressed history of what happened and what changed over the course of 25 years?
Yeah. We're going to try to use our little nugget.
Does it work? Yeah, I can talk about that. I mean, you heard a lot of stage banter. Some of it got very political at times, so it was a great way to get a sense of what people were really feeling about various political movements during especially 60s and 70s, but, also continuing on into that. We got to hear stories from Dave Van Ronk about his relationship to artists. Apparently he and Patrick Sky had a thing. There's a lot of heckling that was really amusing. Dave Van Ronk would heckle people on stage.
Yeah.
And then later on, you would hear someone like Christine Lavin telling a story about how Dave Van Ronk told her to go up to Lena's, and Lena told her to take lessons with Dave Van Ronk. So there were these relationships that really began to come clear from the interstitial banter and introductions, and from Lena talking about it. There was, and those tapes, it's all preserved. It's all at the Library of Congress now.
Yeah, go check it out.
Okay, Benny.
It's for Doctor. I'm not going to be able to meet you for lunch as I wanted to. I'm Vincent Pallode, by the way, for the Institute of Jazz Studies. I was one of the AAA people. I just wanted you to keep in mind, when you do reconstitute this thing, if it does come off, The reason it was originally called Associated Audio Archives. It wasn't about individual archivists so much. It was about institutions, and there was a reason for that. We wanted to get institutions involved because we wanted to make sure that whoever got involved in these projects, the institutions would support them, make sure they got to the conferences or got to the meetings, and use the resources of those particular organizations to do whatever project was being done. And also, we were hoping that we would benefit from whatever project was being done. I wasn't involved in the Regular Deutsch because we weren't part of the Regular Deutsch thing, but we were doing an archivist handbook, which we thought would be very, very useful to have, but the handbook thing never came off. Something else happened and it fell apart. But that was the reason why the Institute of Jazz Studies was involved in AAA at all. So just keep that in mind, that if you want to go back to doing it that way as opposed to individual archivists.
Okay.
If I could just respond, first of all, thank you for that comment. I know who you are and I'd like to be in touch with you anyway. But I appreciate that comment. And Josh Sternfeld, who had to leave, asked me to make it very clear that in the past, and this was actually a point I was trying to make that I don't think I was clear enough, that it isn't, in the past it turned out to be about the big archives. I think it shouldn't be restricted to the big archives. I think it should be bigger, more inclusive than that. And so that also speaks to your point in a way. So.
Okay. One more, Steve?
This is for Jocelyn. The set is great. You know that book is great. I love it. What's the next step in getting it out commercially? Is there going to be a volume two? That's part one. And I haven't been to the website, but are there audio clips there? And will we get to hear Dave Van Ronk talking to Christine Lavin, et cetera? Is it there yet? Is it coming? All that back history. Thanks.
The first part of the question was about a volume two or how to get better access commercially. We've done as much as we can do, I think, to try to get it out there commercially, and the New York Times and Rolling Stone did a feature, so that was but in terms of trying to get that commercial release, we are going to try to utilize more of the material and do a second volume two. We are talking about doing that. And then your second question was about access to some of those recordings on the website. So the database has 30-second samples because of the educational use, and we cleared that with our lawyer. And then you can hear the full material at the Library of Congress if you go to Washington, D.C. And that was the only way that we could do it legally. And since that's the last question, I think I just want to thank you guys for your really wonderful talks, and thank you guys, and kick it back over to Matt. Thank you, Matt, for your help.
Oh, yeah. You're too kind. And once again, thank you all. Can we have a big hand for our panel?